a dish, and from 12 billion miles away, I think the answer was something like 146 astronomical units, was it? I'm trying to remember now. I got it on one of my sheets here from Paul. Paul, how many astronomical units is Voyager out there right now? Voyager number one. Over to you, Paul.
Okay, but you know, you got the dish right and all of that, but as far as Voyager, the two of them, Voyager 1 is a lot further away, but I don't think it's going to make that much of a difference because they're the exact same, you know, the same equipment is on both. So you're up to almost 140, let's call it 138, it's about two more to go for 140. So 138, the other one is, Voyager 2 is, was 114, close to 114. So, I think after a while, you're going to call them really the same. I don't think it's going to make much of a difference there, you know. And, the traveling wave tube will make a big difference, too. Is that what you were saying before, instead of the transistors?
Yeah, when it comes to Voyager doing its transmitting, it's transmitting with a traveling wave tube, which right now is putting out something in the vicinity of 10 watts. 138 astronomical units is very close to 12.8 billion miles. That formula that we gave you earlier, Paul, 136.6 plus 20 log F plus 20 log D. The D you plug in 12.834 billion miles. You're allowed to plug in that number. And for frequency 8.5 gigahertz, 8,500 megahertz, you plug in those numbers, you come up with the free space loss between us and Voyager. I don't know the exact number, but it's probably something like 160 decibels of free space loss. You then plug in the gain of the transmitting dish, you plug in the gain of the receiving dish at Goldstone, and you use 50 hertz of noise equivalent bandwidth, and you can calculate what is the potential sensitivity of Goldstone, and it, by the way, has got a MASER front end, microwave amplification by stimulating emission. It's got a well, 0.2 of a dB noise figure front end at Goldstone. Let me drop it. You go through those calculations, as I've done. You know the mileage, you know the frequency, you know the size of the dishes, you're assuming that everything is properly aimed, you know the free space loss, you plug in the numbers, and you find out that 50 bits per second of transmission, 50 or 100, something like a 50 hertz noise equivalent bandwidth of the receiver, and the numbers come out just right. You end up with something like a 10 dB carrier to noise ratio, which is going to give you something like a very low, you know, 10 to the minus 6 bit error rate of the data that they're getting. And the data is being sent down in packets, which have a cyclic redundancy code built in so you can correct the errors. So we have enough raw data, as I see it there, Joe, that you and I can plug in the numbers, have a mixer front end, and everything comes out just right. So in the vicinity, as I said before, the raw receiver is around minus 146 dBm of sensitivity. Your and my Hewlett-Packard signal generator, let me drop it, can go down to numbers like minus 120 dBm when you turn the dial all the way down to the bottom. And the dial doesn't go any further than that because the leakage of the cabinet would be a stronger signal than what comes out of that front-end connector. So they don't bother going any further. So you and I would have to use some heroic techniques. Like, in order to test that receiver at that sensitivity, you and I would have to mount the receiver in a screen room with a coax connector going through the wall of the double shielded screen room with the signal generator on the outside. And now with the 100 dB of shielding you get from the cabinet of the signal generator, combined with the 100 dB of shielding you get from the screen room, now you could measure the sensitivity of that receiver inside the screen room. See how difficult the thing is so damn sensitive when it's used in that mode that you have to go through some pretty big heroics just to test it on the ground. I wonder if that's some of the information you're looking for, Joe. Darn good question. And when it comes to numbers like this, compared to what you and I normally run into with measuring the sensitivity of a repeater, this thing is really hot. W-H-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the tech man.
I think the 8640B goes actually down about minus 135 if you look at your scale correctly. It definitely goes below 127. It's like minus 135. But anyway, well, you know, it's just a curiosity type of thing because, you know, it was built 40-something years ago, and it is what it is. You can't do anything about how it operates anymore. It's gone. The only thing you can do is put out more power at this end and build a better receiver, like building a better mousetrap. That's all you can do. And finally, you're going to get to one day where the connection is going to be lost. But I was just kind of curious, but it does seem rather interesting. Look at the whole thing. How did they get the receiver to go that narrow? I didn't know they had that kind of technology way back when to actually narrow the receiver. Or is there something else being done to make it apparently seem like it's operating an extremely narrow bandwidth?
Okay, first you said there's nothing more they can do. The design of the Voyager had a lot of adaptability built in. They can give it commands saying, when you're nearby, you can give us the data at a megabit per second. As you get further and further away, like at the distance of Pluto, you got to go down to 100 KC and so on. Well, now they're more than three times the distance of Pluto out there, and they have told the transmitter on board, give us 50 bits per second. And we're going to have the receiver at Goldstone set at a 50 hertz bandwidth. And your first question would be, how in the world, with the Doppler shift of velocities and the rotation of the Earth, just the rotation of the Earth at 8.5 gigs gives you way beyond 50 hertz of Doppler shift. So you got a whole lot of swishing frequencies because of Goldstone being moved as the Earth is rotating, depending on how it's aimed at Voyager, and Voyager's out there at some particular distance. In order for everything to come out right, you know the geometry of where you are on the Earth. You know the exact frequency coming down, because the frequency coming down, it uses your uplink as its reference to transmit the downlink. There's no crystal on board that's drifting away, drifting into a new frequency, if you know what I mean, on Voyager. So you know exactly where to look. And so you can set it for a 50 hertz of bandwidth on the ground. You're now about to ask me, how in the world did they get 50 hertz of receiver bandwidth on Voyager? Let me drop it. You can do that with a spread spectrum technique. Even though your signal is below the noise, in the case of, say for instance, your global positioning satellite receiver system, that receiver in your hand, your GPS receiver, must receive 1 million bits per second. That's the date at which the rate at which the data is being sent from a GPS receiver transmitter 10,000 miles up down to your receiver. So it's around a 10-watt transmitter, 10,000 miles away. You've got a 1 megahertz bandwidth receiver. You go through the calculation, you'll find out the signal getting into your receiver, if you have a 1 dB noise figure front end of your GPS receiver on the ground, your signal starts off 22 dB below the noise, to which you say, hey, no way in hell am I going to receive that. Well, yes, you can. You digitize that signal, and you send the signal with the spread spectrum code. And the spread spectrum code, it's sending the data 1 million bits per second, but the data is a very specific code that you're looking for. And the data, the real data is coming down to you at, I think it's 20 bits per second, either 20 or 50 bits per second on your GPS receiver. It's a very low data rate of the real data after the spread spectrum. The spread spectrum technique has got 30 dB of post-detection processing sensitivity improvement. So I think they're using a very similar technique on Voyager. Voyager itself does not have a 50 hertz bandwidth, but you're sending up a spread spectrum signal, and it knows how to demodulate the spread spectrum signal to get this post-detection signal-to-noise ratio improvement. That's what I think is taking place, Joe. You may have some further questions on this. W-H-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-Y-Y.
Repeater, timeout.
K2LIW in the TechNet. Back to you, Joe, and try to wait for the beeps if there is one.
No, you pretty much answered all the questions I've been curious of, especially, you know, concerning this thing because of the technology available from 40-something years ago. It is amazing that you can still talk to this thing the way you can talk to it. I know you can make improvements to this thing. You can, you know, make a bigger dish. You can put out more power. You can make a better receiver, better low noise amplifier at this end, but you can't do anything at the other end, so it is what it is. But that's still very interesting. And they estimate with all those calculations, just like you, I'm sure they've gone through the same thing, they estimate that this thing could be talked to for another 8 years, give or take, 8, 9 years, 10 years.
Yeah, in a minute I'm going to turn it over to Paul for that one. But right now they told it to transmit, I think it's 50 bits per second. When it gets further and further away and the signal gets weaker and weaker coming down to Goldstone, I think they can tell it, okay, transmit the data to me 25 bits per second. That'll give you another 3 dB signal-to-noise ratio improvement on the downlink, if you know what I mean. So the system has enough adaptability. You give it the right command. I'm amazed. Let's see, 1977 it was launched, and I think that's 39 years ago. I'm amazed that that dish, which has got about a 2-degree or a 1-degree beam width, so that that satellite, 39 years in space, still has the ability to aim that dish in azimuth and elevation to the nearest couple of tenths of a degree. If that high-gain dish, 12-foot diameter, on Voyager, is not aimed precisely at Earth, then all the system goes down the tubes real fast. So the positioning system, the positioning system on Voyager, still this many years downrange, has that accuracy. And I remember asking Paul, are they doing that with inertial wheels? Are they doing that with thrusters? How in the world, 39 years downrange, is that system still able to do that? But I think you've told us, Paul, that right now they are in the talking phase of continuing to communicate. Let me drop. I think NASA has committed to continue to talk to Voyager until the year 2024 or something like that, which is at least 8 years longer, and even that's probably likely to be extended. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, our space expert, K2IW in the TechNet. That thing is way out there, Paul.
Yeah, I don't think the funding goes out that far, but I know the capability, they said, will be to at least 2034 unless something quits on them. So they know they could go that far, and right now they're in the process of making bigger dishes at all these different sites at Goldstone and Canberra and Madrid and Spain. So they're actually increasing the not only the diameters of some of these antennas, but adding antennas. There's so many spacecraft that they're keeping track of now. You know, they have, I think, at least 5 going around Mars, and they have the one they just launched, OSIRIS-REx, and they've got the stereo spacecraft going around the moon, around the sun, stereo A and stereo B. They've got lunar ones, lunar reconnaissance orbiter. There's Juno around Jupiter, Cassini around Saturn. I think I heard 16 some odd spacecraft that tried to do it one time. Kepler, Spitzer, similar. And last I heard was about a year or two ago, it was 600 bits per second. I don't know if that's going to change your formula much, Dick. And as far as the keeping it oriented, they call it dead band orientation. Yeah, this thing's not spinning, it's not rotating, it's just like in one position. And once in a while they have to just move it a little bit one way or the other. And there is fuel on board. And it's not the fuel that's going to run out, it's not the RTG, the radioisotope thermoelectric generator that's going to run out. They think if anything that's going to quit will be these thermocoupling, about, I forget how many, but they're all in series and parallel producing their power. And they're all wrapped up in this graphite blanket being heated by the RTG. And it's the connections between, you know, they're dissimilar metals for the thermal coupling. And they think eventually that would fail. They think that's the failure point. They're still going. Back to you there.
Voyager increases roughly how many astronomical units per year? Question number one. You said that right now they have the capability to talk to it until the year 2034. That's 28 years from now. Oh, amazing. Now, I think the RTG, the radioactive thermal generator on board Voyager, I think there's only one of them. Sure, it'd be nice if they had a backup and two of them. And the heat coming off that RTG goes into the thermocouples. The thermocouples are converting that into electrical power. That heat difference between the radioactive, is it plutonium 238 or something like that? It's in there creating heat. Between that and the heat exchanger, the temperature difference is what the thermocouples sit in, and they generate electrical power. But the thermocouples are being nuclear bombarded, and therefore they're slowly degrading, and therefore the power output, the RTG in the beginning put out X number of watts, probably 150 watts, and for all we know is now down to 60 watts or something like that. You're gonna fill in those numbers, Paul. Let me drop it.
There's three RTGs, and you can see them when you look at the picture of the Voyager.
Three RTGs, and are they combining the voltage out of them by putting them in series and parallel? How are they using those three? Maybe some of them were powering some of the instruments on board, and some of them are powering some of the others, but maybe there's a great big switch matrix. I know that many of them experiments have been turned off. I think that they're continuing to power the traveling wave tube and some of the cosmic ray detectors, they're continuing to power that, but most of the other stuff I think has been turned off. So how are they using the three RTGs of...
Repeater, timeout.
Over to you on how they're using the three RTGs of Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think they're using them as backup. They're all being utilized, and they say a lot of it is going just to keep the equipment warm. Some kind of a heat sink capability to keep the electronics warm. So a lot of it's used for that, and of course they need power. So I don't know if there is, you know. I think it's each one you have to get like 103 watts out of each one when they start off. And they're standardized. They're the same one that's on Cassini is on New Horizon, and they have some kind of standard system that they're using. Because the canister and the size of it was all tested on Earth. They bombed it, they dropped it out of planes, they hit it with rocks, they just tried everything they could to break these canisters open, and they can't do it. And that's because when they launched, you don't want plutonium, you know, coating the surface of the Earth. So, 239, I believe is the uranium that they use. Back to you there. Comment, Dick? Because I looked up something on, was it YouTube? I put Voyager 1 in, and you know what I found out on YouTube? What they have on this thing, too?
You're going to tell us. Wait for the beep and tell us.
Voyager 1, I don't know if Voyager 2 has it, but Voyager 1 has what's called a golden record. It's mounted on the outside of the thing, apparently. And it's a, I don't know how many inch diameter disc, copper disc that's gold plated. And it contains pictures, parts of our language, and other various things to explain to whoever finds this thing, if they can ever decipher it, where it came from and what it is. And I never knew that before. They call that the golden record.
Yeah, there have been a number of NOVA-like presentations on PBS telling you about that record. And I think it was Carl Sagan and his wife who insisted that be put there. And it's got all kinds of information. I think 100 separate languages in the world, people are saying hello in their language on that record. It's got all kinds of pictures of what life on Earth is like. It's got a diagram showing you where all of the known pulsars were located at that time from the Earth point of view. So therefore, by knowing those pulsars and where they appear to look like they're coming from, what angles you get from the Earth, that allows you to tell in three-dimensional space where the spacecraft came from. There's also a diagram showing the then nine planets around Earth, and that Voyager left the third planet, the third rock from the sun. So, and I think the record contains a cartridge, so you can play back the record. There's a digital code. Let me drop it. There's a digital code, which I think uses the hydrogen line frequency as a reference, telling you how fast to turn the record in order for things to sound right. So Carl Sagan, I think it was, insisted that that thing be on board, and the chances of another society picking up Voyager, disconnecting that record, and deciphering it are very, very slim. Sagan admitted that the main reason they did it is to shift the attitude to be more space-oriented for human beings on planet Earth. That record was really done because of the shift in attitude it'll create on people on Earth, as opposed to really intending to communicate with that other extraterrestrial society. Roughly how many astronomical units per year are increasing on Voyager number one? Is it flying away from us at three extra astronomical units per year, something like that, Bob Paul? In which case we can make a rough guess as to how far away it's going to be in the year 2034. WS2N, K2LIW.
Oh, yeah. It's 3.5, roughly 3.5 AU per year on both of them. And, the record, I like the record. And, his wife, Carl Sagan's wife, Anne Duran, was very helpful in gathering all this information. But he insisted on this whole thing, and they had the picture of man and woman on the Pioneer 10 and 11, and they were also leaving the solar system. And when they did Voyager, which was a couple of years later, they upgraded it to put this golden record on. And the pulsars, I know they have the pulsars also on the Pioneer 10 and 11, three pulsars, and then arrows pointing to, you know, where they're coming from, where they could find it in the future. And the goal was to send this thing and hope civilization finds it. It'd be like 40,000 years or something before this ever gets near a star. I think Voyager 2 is going to wind up near Sirius. That's about eight light years away. So give it, 40,000 years or so before that one gets near it. And after that, it'll just keep revolving around the whole galaxy. It's actually going to be in orbit around the galaxy. So every 250 million years, every quarter of a billion years, the galaxy will rotate once, and so will the spacecraft. Now, the goal is, it could be millions of years from now, after the Earth is completely maybe burnt to a cinder by, some crazy group on Earth, or the asteroid comes and takes us all out like the dinosaurs, and the Earth is long gone, but yet somebody out there a billion years from now might find this thing and say, hey, We were there. Back to you, Dirk.
Yeah, let me show you the crazy calculation I just did there for you, Joe. Voyager's out there at 138 astronomical units. And when you take 93 million miles, which is our astronomical unit, multiply 138, you get 12.8 billion miles away from us, three times the distance to Pluto. Paul just told us you increase 3.5 astronomical units per year, and they predict they're going to be able to talk to it until the year 2034. That's 28 years from now. So you take 28 years, 3.5 astronomical units per year. That means in the year 2034, you're going to be adding 99 more astronomical units if it keeps moving at the same rate. 99 astronomical units added to the 138 where we are right now, you come up with 237. So 237 astronomical units is where approximately it will be 28 years from now. We're at 138 astronomical units now. By the inverse square law, you go through that calculation, we're going to lose 4.7 dB of signal strength because of extra free space loss because of that extra range. Let me drop. In order to make up for the 4.7 dB of extra free space loss, whatever bit rate you're using now for transmitting the data, you're going to have to slow that down by 3.1 ratio. So if they're transmitting 600 bits per second now, they're going to have to go down to 200 bits per second in order to get the right signal-to-noise ratio 28 years from now. So built into the spacecraft with enough adaptability. I think when they first launched the spacecraft, I'm not sure that they intended to do a flyby of all of the planets that they did. They got a flyby boost in velocity when they went to that particular, they recognized there was a very lucky alignment of all of the planets, of the outer planets, at the time that Voyager number 1 was launched. And I think a proposal was put out that, hey, let's modify the path a little bit so we fly by all these planets. Not only will we get a close-up view of all these planets, but we'll get this extra boost in velocity. And the net result was that Voyager became, by far, the longest range, longest-lived spacecraft we have ever issued that's still in operation. Let me drop. So I wonder how much of that was really known ahead of time. That all of this extra capability of changing the bit rates, enough accuracy for aiming and enough fuel on board and whatever, I wonder how much of that was really known in the beginning. I think when Voyager was first launched, I don't think they intended in the beginning to fly by that many planets. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
They knew that planets were aligned correctly. They didn't know if they were going to get funding to continue on. You know, they definitely knew that Neptune was a possibility, you know. But to get there, they were just hoping one would be able to make it because they built redundancy into everything that stood. So they had Voyager 2 and Voyager 1. 2 actually launched before 1. A week or two apart, whatever it was. What happened was, they were, you know, they passed Jupiter, and then they wanted to go to Saturn. And everybody in the science community really wanted to get a look at Titan, the big moon around Saturn. Titan was covered in this nitrogen haze, completely clouded in. So if we can get Voyager to go near that, that would really work out great. But to do that, they needed to change the trajectory on one of them. So they changed the trajectory on Voyager 1. They left Voyager 2 to do what they call the Grand Tour. So they passed Jupiter, Voyager 2, Voyager 2 passed Saturn, and then that went on to Uranus and eventually Neptune. It happened to stay in the ecliptic plane. Drop it. Voyager 1 was one that they were sacrificing. They said, you know, we're happy getting one spacecraft to get to those two outer planets, Uranus and Neptune. But we're going to find out what this Titan is about. So they change the trajectory, and by doing that, they will actually angle it, you know, it had to go near the moon, and when it did, it went kind of like toward the south of the moon, and that sent it out 30 degrees north of the ecliptic. So there's no way in the world that was going to go to Uranus, Neptune, or Pluto, or anywhere. So that was, you know, going to have to be north of the ecliptic plane. And unfortunately, it was more clouded than they could possibly imagine. They really didn't get any too much good data from the flyby. But what they got was Voyager 1 was now passing Voyager 2 because it's going on a more of a direct shot out of the solar gravity well, where Voyager 2 is still kind of like circling. You know, it's going more in a circular motion, although, you know, eventually that's going to be out of solar gravity well altogether, too. So that's what happened, Dick. Back to you.
Yeah, Voyager number one is the fastest moving one compared to Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. From what you just told us, Paul, Voyager 1 got a gravity assist by flying by some planets, but it flew by a much smaller number of planets than Voyager 2. So how can less gravity assist of flying by less planets give you more velocity? How does Voyager 1 end up going so darn fast if it didn't fly by as many planets? Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
Well, the speeds are roughly the same. Voyager 2 is going a little slower. But when you can imagine passing Jupiter and passing Saturn, you know, you're really curving around following these planets, and then Uranus and Neptune is, you know, further in front of you. You're almost heading for an orbit, a heliocentric type of orbit around the sun, where the other one, you know, once it got to Saturn, you know, they had that going straight, you know, away from the sun. So it's one is curving around, you know, kind of like following the orbit of Neptune, except much further out now. He's still curving around, but going out. And the other one is, you know, on a dead straight path away from here. So it's the distance from Saturn straight out compared, you know, imagine the other one going around, curving along, following the other spacecraft. It would be a lot closer to the sun than it is now. It's out there now because of that one change that they made. Back to you, Dick.
Voyager 1 is by Jupiter and Saturn. Did it fly by any other planets up, Paul? Did Voyager 2 fly by four planets and Voyager 1 only fly by two? Run that by one more time, Paul. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. Think of it this way. You know, you're taking a 33 and a third LP, you know, and you look at your spacecraft launch, say, from the center. And if you send one out, and when it gets to Saturn, you change its trajectory toward, you know, toward Uranus and then toward Neptune, and you're running along the edge of the LP now, where when the other one got to Saturn roughly the same time, within a couple week time frame, you didn't change the path to follow along the circumference of the record. You just let it head straight out, you know, following the radius of the record straight out. So, it's gonna, you know, even if they're traveling at the same distance, one is curved around the sun and the other one's going straight. I think that's probably a better way to put it. Back to you.
Yeah, the 138 astronomical units that the Voyager has gone, by the inverse square law, that means that the amount of sunlight Voyager is getting is a ratio of 138 squared, which is 19,000. In other words, the amount of sunlight Voyager is getting is 19,000 times weaker than we're getting here right now. And we're getting 1.3 kilowatts per square meter. 1.3 exponential 3. It is 1.3 kilowatts per square meter. You decrease that by 19,000. And Voyager is getting, if I got it correctly, 68 milliwatts per square meter. It's getting very little sunlight. My guess is if you were sitting on Voyager and you look back at the sun, it would look like many of the other stars we see in the sky. I think it would see a star that's 10.7 magnitudes dimmer than our sun. That's still a pretty bright star, though. But the amount of solar energy they're getting is milliwatts. If they had huge solar panels on there, they wouldn't stand a chance. It had to be a nuclear power supply. Let me drop a quick. So somehow the heat coming off the three RTGs is being directed to some of the experiments to keep them warm. When you're that far away from the sun, the amount of solar radiation you're getting is only milliwatts, very little. The background temperature of free space is 2.73 degrees Kelvin. So if you're really far away from the sun, your satellite wants to settle down at 2.73 degrees Kelvin. That's minus 180 degrees centigrade, if you know what I mean. It's really, really cold. And so a lot of that electronics wouldn't work at all if it wasn't for the local heating. I think the original Voyager had two separate traveling wave tubes. I believe one of them has failed. I think they're on the backup traveling wave tube. Maybe there's even a backup receiver they're on. And enough fuel on board to talk to it until the year 2034, 28 years to go. Oh, amazing. That is one heck of a spacecraft. So by some means, the extra heat being given off is heating the electronics. And so we know roughly how many watts they're getting out of it, and only if there are only one or two experiments running now, the transmitter plus maybe the nuclear detector, WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I know every year they drop down 4% or something in power, so they kept shutting stuff down to conserve on that to make it last longer. And I think the only thing left working is like the plasma detector, you know, whatever detects the ions in the atmosphere and the transmitter. And I think every week, that goes by, they do transmit up to the Voyager and have it send information back. And I believe it's 600 bits per second. I don't think we're down to 50 yet. I'll have to check that again. There were interesting flights. We now have 5 vehicles leaving the solar system. Pioneer 10, 11, they quit working. And now we have New Horizons. So I think that has 2 RTGs on it, not one. And the one on Mars, Curiosity, has 1. I believe that, again, that's 103 watts of power for every RTG. So, electrically, you know, you got the capability of going up to, say, a little over 300 watts on Voyager. And I'm sure that percentage has dropped down tremendously over the years. I don't know what it's down to, but I know it's 24 watts. Transmitter has really gone way down too. I probably timed this out. WS2N.
No, you didn't, Paul. 24 watts going into the transmitter. The actual RF power output, I'm estimating, is more like 10 watts. for the whole transmitter. Now, there's one RTG on Curiosity on Mars, one RTG on New Horizons, but three of them on Voyager. Wow! Are all these RTGs the exact same model number, so to speak, the exact same power output? And how in the world, I guess they put three of them on Voyager, knowing that it's going to be a very long mission, and each one of those RTGs is going to go down in power output X percentage per year. Is that the way it's done? So is there one universal design for all of those RTGs up all 103 watts in the beginning? WS2N, K2IW.
Yeah, I know they're the same. I'll have to check on the how many are in on each one. Got to verify Voyager. I'm pretty sure it was three. When I get on the computer, I don't know. I'm pretty sure it was three. And then I believe New Horizon was two. It needed a backup. And then there's one on Curiosity. And I believe 103 is the number. And even back to the 70s, they're using the same design. You know, they got the okay space flight ready on these canisters. And I guess they said, that's it. We're not going to go through this again to prove to the public that these things work. And you got to remember, Pioneer had one, Pioneer 10, Pioneer 11. So they went out of the solar system, too. They quit working. I don't know what failed on them. These voyages are going, you know, and both of them, they keep on going. That's amazing. You know, I wouldn't be surprised to hear on the news one day one failed, but just like the two rovers on Mars, you know, they sent Spirit and Opportunity. And Spirit quit. It took them 6 years, but it finally quit after 6 years. And it was, they were designed to go for 3 months, both of them. And Opportunity is still going. And it landed in 2004. Cassini has the RTGs on board as well, but Juno doesn't. So, and they're going to burn up Cassini this year in September. Going to send that into the atmosphere of Saturn. That's going to be the end of Cassini. That's a shame, but that's the way it goes.
In the case of Curiosity, which is this great big craft walking around Mars, almost the size of a Volkswagen, and is running on one single RTG, 103 watts. And there's a lot of experiments on board. It's a big, heavy craft that has to wheel itself across Mars. Wow. That must be a very efficient system, because they're getting a lot for their money at one RTG. I'm amazed that Curiosity only has one RTG. It's the biggest thing we've ever landed on any other planet. It's got a lot of experiments on board, and it's holding itself around on that surface, as well as creating enough heat to keep all of its experiments warm, because the average temperature on Mars is something like minus 60 degrees. By our standards, that's damn cold. Almost doesn't matter when you're down to that number, whether you talk about centigrade or Fahrenheit. Minus 40 centigrade and minus 40 Fahrenheit, all the same number. So the Martian winter, I think, goes down to numbers like minus 150 degrees. So you really need that heater. Curiosity has been through how many Martian winters so far, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, it landed in August of 2012. So here we are, just over 4 years. So a little over two years on Mars. About 2 years on Mars. So two winters. And unlike Spirit and Opportunity, they had to park and do nothing for the winter times on Mars. Curiosity gets to keep going. It doesn't need the sun. And that thing is... if you look at the picture of curiosity. On the back, it looks like a tail coming up. And that's, you can see the RTG, and it looks like a couple of radiators are attached to it. It's located right next to the UHF antenna. The UHF antenna is, looks like a coffee can, you know, upside-down coffee can, sitting on the top, what's called the starboard side. So, it's really good. I mean, you know, it's got six wheels, it's got this bogey suspension thing. If, let's say, the left wheel goes up on a big two-foot rock, it will actually force the right wheel down. By doing that, though, the idea is to keep the whole body perfectly level, as level as they can, as it drives along. And it's doing good. It's got some wheel damage from some of the sharp rocks. Now they're avoiding that. But otherwise, it's supposed to be in pretty good shape. So, I don't know. Maybe when we get there, when people get there, maybe this thing will still be riding around with its one RTG power source. Back to you, Dick. Oh, by around, I think 1,300 watts or something is coming out, temperature-wise. 1,300 BTUs. I forgot know the number, but a lot of the heat. I think the equivalent of 1,300 watts, I think, is what the number is on the RTGs.
Leslie Thermal out right now. Spirit and Opportunity, I'm pretty sure they're running on solar cells, so that really limited their capability. And during the time that you're not getting sunlight each Mars nighttime, you have to live on batteries. The RTG that's on Curiosity, you can run that 24/7 because you're always getting lots of thermal power, and I think 103 watts or something like that of electrical power out of it. In the case of Voyager, I think you don't need batteries. I think you're continuously running on the power coming out of those three RTGs. So even if you had battery failure, Voyager keeps right on running. No matter what they used for rechargeable batteries, after 39 years, I suspect those batteries are relatively useless. So I think Voyager almost doesn't need batteries because you've got continuous power coming out of the RTG. Is that roughly true, Paul, of US2N, KQLAW?
Yeah, I thought about that. I envision these big computer-grade capacitors attached to it. To pick up any kind of fluctuations in the voltage, but I don't know. I'm sure those batteries are dead. In fact, they might be a problem. Maybe there's a way to shut them off completely, you know, switch them out of the circuit. You know, they might actually cause a problem. I don't know that. I've never seen the schematic on this thing. Now, you mentioned Opportunity and Spirit, Opportunity still riding around. That does have like a 239 uranium source that they put inside the web, or they call it the web is the warm electronic box. That's the name they give it. And inside that, this thing is a couple of these. I guess they're battery size. Plutonium giving off heat, so they're not tapping the electricity on that, but they're taking the heat. When it gets dark, which is every day on Mars, you know, they have roughly a 24-hour day like we do. I think a little bit longer, like 40 minutes longer. But at night, it gets so cold that you would use up all the electricity that you got from the sun during the day just to run electric heaters to keep this thing warm. So they use radioactivity from a plutonium source, and they came up with that originally on the other rover. Remember the small one? Pathfinder landed on Mars and then off-rolled Sojourner. Sojourner was the little rover about the size of...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Sojourner, how was Sojourner powered up, Paul?
Yeah, it had solar panels on its back, but it had the plutonium inside to keep the electronics warm. That's why they call it the web, the warm electronic box, you know, on these things. And they sealed everything off with just the wires are coming out. They made a big deal out of that just to keep the electronics warm. So that's how that's powered. And so was the lander itself, the Pathfinder, that had the same thing, plus solar panels.
So the warm electronic box on Sojourner was heated up with either plutonium-239 or uranium-238, one of those nuclear sources of heat. But doesn't that nuclear radiation also cause damage to the electronics if it's not nuclear hardened? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
I saw pictures of it. It looked like, I don't know, nine D batteries about that size, very small. And apparently the radiation that's given off from this is not, it's not affecting it. I mean, they're just using it for heat. So whether they needed some kind of shielding from it or not, I don't know. But that's what they use, and they use that on the other two rovers as well. And you'll eventually see that on Mars, the Mars Express, or what is it called, the ExoMars mission that European Space Agency is planning for a couple of years from now, probably 2020. You'll see it again on our new rover, the 2020 rover, that's going to look like Curiosity. And even China's making one. They shoot for 2020 as well. That's going to be a fun year. Back to you, Dick.
And we're about to run out of time. This was TechNet number 1,632. Space Report number 232. Bye-bye, you all. We'll be back next week. Be kind to each other. And there's another question I was going to ask you about thermal. Can't think of it right now. But keeping Voyager warm way out there where it's only getting milliwatts of heat from the sun per square meter. The onboard RTG is the only thing that can keep it from... going down to numbers like 3 degrees Kelvin of thermal temperature, pool, and that's cold. WS2S for a final, K2RIW. Thank you, Paul. Bye-bye. Back to you.
Okay, real good. And, yeah, we were talking about how bright the star was. The sun would look like probably a bright star. The sun starts off here at Earth at minus 28, negative 28 magnitude. Negative 27, I believe it was. So by the time you get out to where they are, you can actually figure that number out, because that's done in logarithmic too. You can actually figure that out if as bright as Cirrus or something. Back to you, Dick, and 73, everybody. Will be back next week. Have a good week. Good Christmas. It's coming up next Sunday. I don't know what we're going to do. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, if I did it right, I calculated 10.7 units of magnitude, solar magnitude, you lose because of the 138 astronomical units. Minus 27, and you lose 11, you're still down to minus 16. That's still that's a very bright star, a lot brighter than Sirius. So as far away as you are from the sun, it's still the brightest star in the sky that Voyager can see. Even though you're not getting much heat from it, it still makes it a very good target. And if they aim that dish at the sun, let's do a quick calculation. Is that close enough to being aimed at the Earth, if you know what I mean? With the fraction of a degree of beam width of that dish. Bye-bye, Paul. See you next week. K2RIW.
That's probably what they're doing. I know there's a hole in the middle of the dish, and that looks directly at the sun. So maybe that's what they're doing. Catch you next week. Christmas and then New Year's after that, both on Sundays. We'll see how many check-ins we get. WS2 England.
interesting point, Paul. Next Sunday is Christmas. Is there going to be a TechNet next Sunday? You and I are about to make that decision right now. What's your first impression on that one, Paul?
If I celebrate Christmas here, I'll be here. Get rid of the relatives before 8 o'clock. Excuse me.
Okay, we could keep it simple. Since Christmas falls right on the TechNet weekend, we can say there will be no TechNet next week. That would be the simplest way to go. What do you think?
I concur. And then the next week, you got New Year's. I got straight key night that night. I will do both.
In the case of New Year's, I see New Year's, you really separate. You really celebrate it on the evening of December 31. So New Year's night, the celebration is over. So holding a TechNet on New Year's night, that's not so difficult. But on Christmas night, that's a little more difficult. I think we're going to declare no TechNet next week on Christmas. Bye-bye for now, Paul. T2RIW.
KD2CBV, comment.
CBV, go right ahead.
Go ahead. Don't have a TechNet next week, Santa Claus is going to get right down angry about it because he waited a whole year.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Tonight at 8:30 W2VL repeater system.
This is KV2MMA monitoring. KV2MHI listening.
Good morning, WA2CDL.
Good morning, this is Scott in Queens. Who turned off the heat? It is cold out this morning.
Yeah, well, it's just about winter. Yeah, this is Andy here. I just happen to be listening in. Okay. Winter's what? 2 days away? Wednesday? So, yeah, temperatures have been, as you know, fluctuating quite a bit. But it's supposed to warm up the rest of the end of the week. It's supposed to get back to the 40s where, you know, it's more normal.
I'm hopeful for that. I mean, yesterday was like almost 60, and then today it's almost 30. It's like dropped almost 30 degrees in like overnight. It's unbelievable. All right. Well, I'm driving off to my next destination, so I'll be happy to talk and, I'll keep you company if you want to talk.
All right, I'm home. Still, I won't be leaving for work for a while. So, just wanted to say hi. So I was listening in. Listening to, probably Peter's been quiet. And that's about it over here. Just another week coming up, but it's going to be, it's abbreviated, obviously, because Christmas is coming, and I guess, it's a couple of days away.
Yes, it is. I think Christmas is going to be
Sunday, so
we got a short week. This week we got a